from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, Congresswoman Jackie Speier is with us. Last week, the Bay Area Democrat called for removing President Trump from office by invoking the 25th Amendment because the president, she says, appears unable to do the job.
There's actually a growing mountain of evidence that the president has been very erratic, has shown a mental instability.
Speier is also a member of the House committee investigating Russian interference in last year's election, and she serves on the Armed Services Committee, where she's pushed back on sexual assault against women in the military. Lots to talk with her about, and we'll get started right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, we're continuing our series of conversations with Bay Area members of Congress. And here with us today, Democrat Jackie Speier. Her 14th congressional district includes parts of San Francisco and the peninsula in San Mateo County. First elected in 2008, Speier serves on the House Intelligence Committee, which is investigating Russian interference in last year's election. And she also is on the House Armed Services Committee. Last week, Congresswoman Speier became the first member of Congress to call for invoking the 25th Amendment, enacted to remove presidents who are deemed unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office. Jackie Speier, welcome to Forum.
Great to be with you, Scott.
Of course, I do want to talk with you about President Trump, but let me begin with what everyone is talking about here in the Bay Area this morning, and that is the National Park Service deciding to give a permit with conditions to the Patriot Prayer Group that's going to hold a right-wing rally in Chrissy Field, on Chrissy Field over the weekend. What are your thoughts about that?
So I joined with our leader, Nancy Pelosi, in urging the acting superintendent not to issue a permit. And in my conversations with the superintendent, she said, and rightfully, that she had to comply with the rules and make sure that the First Amendment was being protected, and they were making an assessment as to whether or not there was an imminent threat. And that was the only condition on which they could not grant the permit. So the permit was granted yesterday with a list of, I think, 26 different conditions. And they are now going to have them really be bused in. They're going to have to be checked. They can't bring in anything that could resemble a weapon. And they're going to be, you know, very limited. So I guess at this point, I believe that we are protecting the First Amendment and that the permit actually gives greater protection to the Bay Area residents because there are conditions imposed. Whereas if the permit was not granted, they would still have shown up. There would not have been the organized effort to, you know, separate the groups and, you know, allow for the free speech to be engaged in by both sides.
So your position has evolved on that?
It actually has evolved, yes.
And so do you think, I mean, yesterday Congresswoman Pelosi put out a statement questioning who had made the decision and why, I think suggesting that perhaps it came from on high, maybe as far as the White House, who knows. But do you have concerns about that as well, in spite of your sort of evolution on your position on this?
In this administration, anything's possible. And the leader could very well have inside information that I'm not privy to. So regardless of what may have occurred in the decision-making, the decision has now been made. The safety of Bay Area residents, I believe, is enhanced by a permit with these very specific conditions. And this Patriot Prayer Group is very small. I mean, the number may be as small as 20 or 30. And their interest is in getting attention, which they've gotten, increasing their numbers, which may or may not occur, and generating financial resources.
Although they may also attract other right-wing groups like this, the Oath Keepers, the militia, who have brought weapons to events in the past, although because of the permit restrictions, they may not be able to do that this weekend.
Right.
Where will you be?
Actually, it is Women's Equality Day, and so I am taking two busloads of high school girls to Richmond, California, to the Rosie the Riveter Museum, because on Women's Equality Day, it's great to celebrate the fact that during World War II, when women took over the jobs of men in the shipyards in the Bay Area, they got paid exactly the same wages as the men who had been doing the jobs before them.
Supply and demand.
That's right. Well, it was also, you know, a fresh breath of equality that we saw then that would be nice to replicate again.
Yeah. I want to ask you about another item in the news that's relevant to your committee, and that is news that the White House is going to be sending over details of the transgender policy change that President Trump announced via Twitter a few weeks ago. It sounds like the president is wanting to give some leeway to General Mattis, the defense secretary. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, obviously, you opposed the policy change from what the Obama administration had put in place. But what are you hearing? What are your concerns?
I have been working with the transgender community for over 2 years on this issue, and actually was going to introduce legislation over a year ago. And they wanted me to hold back because they thought that the administration was going to move quickly and that we would get it in place. Well, the administration finally did move under Obama, but very late in his term. So we are now in this situation where we have anywhere from, I'd say, 3,000 to 10,000 service members who are transgender in the military right now. If they were relieved of their duties, there would be a huge hole in the military in terms of our readiness, cohesion, all the issues that we look at in terms of our preparedness to go to war. Secondly, the number of transgender members in the military has, I think, already established that there is no issue. There is no issue in terms of how they interact with their colleagues. The number of
And the cost, the Rand Corporation.
Frankly, the costs are de minimis. It's something like only 2% actually seek reassignment surgery. The cost to the health care of the military is 0.001%
Less than what they spent on Viagra, well, I think, as someone pointed out.
Yeah, it's something like, I don't know, 15 times more was spent on Viagra in the military than the costs associated with reassignment. So it's once again an indication that our president knows only one thing, and that is to play to his base. He is no longer campaigning to be president of the United States. He is now the president of the United States and needs to be the president for all Americans. I think General Mattis, or I should say Secretary Mattis, has imposed as much as he can some I don't know, boundaries over what I think originally would have been recommended, and gives him much more latitude.
It was interesting, and we saw it on the transgender policy, but and we've seen it on also his reaction, the president's reaction to Charlottesville, the military pushing back with their own statements, the Joint Chiefs saying there will be no policy change until we get some details in writing from the White House. How surprised were you and are you that you're seeing this sort of challenge to the commander-in-chief from the leaders of the military? I know it's not unprecedented. We've seen it on troop levels and those kinds of things, but it's awfully...
It makes me very proud to be an American because these military leaders are putting country before party or politics. And they know full well the potential risks associated in this case of just pulling all of these members of the military, who many of whom have very significant roles within the military, and create these holes that have there's just no rational reason to do this, which, you know, takes us to the whole discussion about the rationality of the president. But, you know, any number of issues that we look at that the president has weighed in on have been the subject of a fair amount of pushback by his military leaders. And I'm very grateful that he has General McMaster and Secretary Mattis and now Chief of Staff Kelly surrounding him, because they are disciplined individuals. They have been, you know, they have spent their lives in the military, and it trains them in ways that the president cannot you know, begin to replicate.
Does it surprise you as a Democrat?
Yes, it does. I know where you're going.
to feel reassured that there are generals in so many positions that are often held by civilians in a presidential administration?
Yes, it surprises me. But this is not a normal presidency. And it's been articulated over and over again. But having these generals in these positions are putting some sanity in a place where there is a lack of. And it appears the president respects them. You know, they're older, seasoned individuals, and I think he relates to them in a way that he didn't relate to some of the other members of his team.
Although he said during the campaign he knew more than the generals. I guess he's changed his mind on that.
What do we know about what he thinks from day to day? You know, he knew more than the generals. Healthcare was easy. I mean, those bellicose statements that came out during the campaign and come out now as president are not anything we can rely on.
Talking with Bay Area Democrat Jackie Speer. She represents the 14th Congressional District, the southern part of San Francisco, and parts of the peninsula as well. You have called for removal of the president based on the 25th Amendment, which allows for that if the vice president, a majority of the cabinet, send a signal, a message asking for that because the president is unable to do perform the duties. How lightly did you make that decision? I mean, or maybe frame it another way, what went into the decision to call for that?
I have been worried about the state of our country for months now. I serve on the Intelligence Committee. I interact with foreign, what we call interlocutors, all the time. And I've been to Europe on Intelligence Committee trips. I am concerned about our national security. I was in Czechoslovakia when the president was speaking out with the sound and fury that the world has never seen against Kim Jong-un. And I'm thinking to myself, this is not presidential. This is not what we expect out of our president. And he is placing our country at the gravest risk by inflaming the relationship that is already not great with North Korea. Then you couple that with what happened with his, you know, many speeches now on Charlottesville and his willingness to somehow want to recreate history and divide our country. He is really hell-bent on dividing this country. The combination of all those, plus the fact that since his presidency, there has been documentation that he has lied to the American people over 1,000 times. And what is clearly a mental instability and aberrant behavior that we see day in and day out is harmful. Is truly harmful. And I will guarantee you that there are members of the House and the Senate on the Republican side and the Democratic side that feel just like I do. And we talk about it privately. I'm just the first person that's actually come out and said it.
So you're hearing that from Republican colleagues
as well? Oh, absolutely.
Well,
Senator Corker, I mean, here's the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, who was actually a contender to be a vice president himself and was vetted for that purpose, saying that he does not believe that the president is showing the stability for the job. So in many respects, I feel like I'm the child at the parade watching the emperor pray down the street without any clothes on and am saying, but he doesn't have any clothes on.
What I mean, at this point, you know, both impeachment and invoking the 25th Amendment is in large measure a political act, you know, and so in order for it to happen just as a practical matter, you would need a majority of Republicans, let alone a majority of the cabinet, to agree with the position you're taking. What would it take to get to the point where that is a serious conversation?
Well, the reason why I'm speaking out about the 25th Amendment is because I believe that that is the swiftest way to maintain stability in the country and around the world. And I'm imposing, I guess, by calling out the vice president and the cabinet to assess the president. Now, this isn't the first time it's happened. I mean, we do know that Baker
Woodrow Wilson
actually had his wife running the presidency when he was incapacitated. But, you know, during President Reagan's presidency, and there's a book that just recently come out in which, you know, James Cannon was asked to go and determine what the situation was. And, you know, he came back and said there was chaos and the president, you know, wants to sit around and watch old movies. And, you know, there was great concern then. And then I think members of the cabinet were queried. And then
during the Reagan administration?
Yes. And then eventually Howard Baker spent some time with President Reagan and made an assessment that he thought that, you know, he was lucid. Now, I'm asking the vice president and the members of the cabinet who are closest to him, who engage with him on a regular basis, to look at that and make the assessment. None of us are schooled as psychotherapists or psychologists, but the 25th Amendment doesn't ask us to be. The 25th Amendment is there to provide the means by which someone who is in that position as president, who is incapacitated, can be asked to step aside. And I think that assessment needs to be made. And at the very least, having a conversation about this is going to keep everyone alert to what's at stake here.
What is it? You know, one of the things that characterizes his presidency is this obsession, it seems, with erasing everything Barack Obama did when he was president. And we see that with the transgender policy and many other things. What do you think that's about?
You know, it's hard to get into the president's mind, certainly. I think he lashed out so strongly about President Obama and that administration. But, you know, it's like everything else. He was against the Afghanistan war, but now as president, he realizes that it's not so easy. And he oftentimes speaks from ignorance, and that's very dangerous.
You think there's an element of race or racism there?
Oh, I can't speak to that. I mean, there could be, but, you know, he now wants to lock up Hillary Clinton again. I mean, it's that aberration. It's the instability. It's the lurching from one position to the other that is creating an instability here and around the world.
One of the things all of this has done is taken Russia off the front pages. You're on the committee, the Intelligence Committee, that's investigating that with Devin Nunes as the chair, although I guess he has sort of recused himself.
Yes, yeah, sort is the operative word there.
But he's still on the committee. How much confidence do you have? Of course, we've got Robert Mueller also doing what seems to be a robust investigation. He's really hiring, staffing up with some very high-powered attorneys. They're looking at his finances, the president's finances, and so on. But what do you think that your committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee, both doing investigations into Russia, what do you think you can add that Robert Mueller won't?
So our job is very different from Robert Mueller's. He is looking at criminal conduct. We are not charged with that responsibility. We are charged as Intelligence Committee members to look at to what extent our intelligence it has been somehow breached. The safety of our country has somehow been impeded. And, you know, our investigation is more into to what extent Russia intervened in our elections and to what extent, if there was coordination by the Trump campaign with the Russian operatives, whether they were within Putin's sphere or cutouts, as they refer to them. And that's our main responsibility. Now, I think there's an equally serious responsibility that we haven't quite addressed yet, and I'm just now starting to look at it. There was a hackathon that took place in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago. And it was, I think for the most part, they were hackers and they were professors that were part of this effort. They had purchased online, on eBay, I guess, an actual machine, a voting machine. It actually had the software in it. And they were able to hack into it in less than 10 minutes. Now, we have this sense, and I've talked to many of our our Secretary of State, my local individual who's responsible for elections. And everyone has this sense that, well, you know, these machines are offline, so they're not connected to the internet. Well, first of all, that's not exactly true. From time to time, they are.
And the voter rolls are online.
And voter rolls are online. We know that the voter rolls in some areas were actually impacted. So this is a real serious problem. And we have lots of different systems working in counties throughout California and around the country. Even though you license the software from a particular company as a local elections director, you cannot red team it, which means you can't attempt to hack into it. So even though you have the license for that software, you are precluded to determine whether or not it's safe. So that's a huge problem moving forward. And we need to be prepared because Russia has never left. They're here now. They are hacking now. And they will be engaged in 2018 and in 2020. And we have got to get prepared.
As a member of the House Intelligence Committee, of course, you receive briefings that others are not privy to. They're, you know, with high security clearance that you have. Do those briefings make you more concerned about all these things, the safety of the country, the security for the country, the role the president and his campaign may have played in colluding with Russia? Does it make you more or less confident about, you know, where the country is?
That's a hard question to answer. There are periods of time when I have felt very confident, and there are periods of time when I'm very anxious about our status. I do think we have some of the best people you could possibly ask for serving our country around the world as intelligence officers. The people that work at CIA and NSA, and at DIA, which is the office within the military, are really remarkable people, and they really do put their country first. So I think that what's interesting and what I have found kind of surprising, we're required not to share anything. My husband sometimes say, "Can't you tell me something?" I said, "No, I can't tell you something or I'll have to kill you." But it's surprising how much actually comes out.
Meaning leaked?
Well, whether it's leaked or made public at some point in time. So the American people have a window into what our intelligence community is doing. And the most recent one that became public, and we just were made aware of it maybe, you know, 4 months ago, was the intelligence officers in Cuba, or embassy officers, I should say, that were being impacted by strange radio waves that were impairing both their hearing and, in some cases, they had concussions. And that kind of takes your breath away. And here we are attempting to, you know, create normalized relations with Cuba, and this is going on. We're not certain even now who's responsible, but that really violates some very fundamental principles.
And then just quickly, actually, you know, we're coming up on a break. I'll come back to that thought in a moment. We're talking with Congresswoman Jackie Speier, Democrat from the Bay Area. If you'd like to join us, if you have a question for her about any of the things we've talked about or something else, give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and my guest this hour is Bay Area Congresswoman Jackie Speier, Democrat from San Francisco and down in the peninsula as well. If you'd like to join us, give us a ring at 866-733-6786. During the break, we were talking briefly about Kate Steinle, the woman who was shot and killed in San Francisco. Her case became a cause célèbre for candidate Trump, and it continues to be an issue around sanctuary city laws. There is a bill in Congress named after Kate Steinle. Talk about that. You have expressed support for that bill, unlike many in the Bay Area. Tell us about it and why you do.
I voted for it. And I had Kate's dad and brother in my office after she had died. And they are just incredible Americans. And it was all about making sure that this didn't happen to someone else. This particular language, give or take, was in the comprehensive immigration reform legislation that was bipartisan that came out of the U.S. Senate a number of years ago. So this was something that everyone signed off on, immigration groups, Republicans, Democrats.
And just describe what it is.
So it basically gives discretion to a judge to have someone who is undocumented and who has committed crimes to be deported after they serve time. So you can actually imprison them for committing these crimes and then deport them. The alleged killer of Kate Steinle he was undocumented. He had been convicted in Oregon, Washington, and I believe Arizona 5 times for drug possession and manufacturing.
And he had been deported like 4 or 5 times.
He had been deported. He came back in. At some point, I think that someone who commits crimes doesn't have the right to live here. I support immigration reform. I've always been an outspoken supporter of creating a pathway for citizenship. I speak with my DACA students all the time and urge them, frankly, to sign up for DACA to protect themselves because it allows them to stay in the country for a period of 2 years and go to school and work. So I think the president has used this in a manner that is, trying to demonize immigrants. And I'm not at all interested in that. But I am interested in the safety of all persons who live in this country. And if someone violates the law, commits crimes, they don't have a right to stay here.
I think maybe Eric Swalwell supported it as well, because I think her parents live over in his district in the East Bay.
I think he went to school with her, too.
With Kate?
I believe he knew her.
But most Democrats in the Bay Area are opposing that. And I'm wondering, the issue of sanctuary cities and undocumented people coming into this country illegally has been a big issue. And here in California, there are some 3 to 4, I think, million undocumented immigrants. And I'm wondering, do you think that the party sometimes errs too far on the side of protecting people who are here without documents, even if they haven't broken the law?
Well, if they haven't broken the law,
other than coming here illegally.
Right. And our law-abiding people living in our communities, working in our communities, I think that what we should be doing is creating a means by which they can become citizens if they're inclined to do so. The truth is, if you look at those who build our homes and do our landscaping and serve us in restaurants, that is the undocumented population in California. And without them, those jobs would probably not be completed. So,
but as a political matter, I think there's a criticism from some in the party for example, some of the white working class voters who fled the party and perhaps supported Donald Trump didn't see anything in the Democrats and Hillary Clinton's campaign's message for them. They saw a lot of focus on Latinos, people of color, women, but not so much for working class, white men in particular. And is that something the party needs to address?
Oh, there's no question we do. I think Joan Williams has written a book called White Working Class that I just read. That's really an excellent book. And it makes the case that the Democrats are always the party of working Americans. And there's this sense that we have somehow left them, and we have got to reengage. And, you know, part of our, I think our message is we are here, we're there for you. You know, the better deal is all about better jobs, better wages, and a better future.
All right. Let's go to the phones now. Carrie in San Jose, you're on with Congresswoman Jackie Speier.
Good morning. The Electoral College seems to be operating in the exact opposite way that it was envisioned, and I wanted to know what you think about it and if there's any serious efforts to get rid of the Electoral College and go back to the concept of one person, one vote.
Well, such a good question, Carrie. One of the big takeaways I had from the book that Joan Williams wrote was her point that the Electoral College creates an environment where lower population states have a bigger say in the presidency. And while we've only had two elections recently, in 2000 and again in 2016, where the popular vote went to one candidate, Al Gore and Hillary Clinton, but the Electoral College went to the Republican. That is going to continue to be a problem. So it's
not a problem for Republicans.
It's not a problem for Republicans, but it's a problem for all the people in the state, Republicans and Democrats, who live on the coasts, right? Who are in where one vote, one person, one vote doesn't have the same amount of clout that it does in the middle of the country. I mean, California. Take our population. You would have to add up the population of 13 other states to equal the population of California. So to your question, Carrie, I don't know how feasible it is in the near term, but the more and more elections that turn out like 2000 or 2016 is going to require us to look at it.
But her point that it's not working out the way it was envisioned, I mean, in fact, like so many things about the founding of our country, it was a compromise. And
it was
to protect smaller states from the tyranny of the big states, which at that time were New York and Virginia and Pennsylvania. And now, as you said, there's a disparity in presidential elections and also in the Senate. I mean, Wyoming, how many people does Wyoming have?
600,000, I think, yeah.
They got two senators.
Right.
Just like us.
Yeah.
But really, realistically, there's not a lot. I mean, that would require, obviously, a change to the Constitution. Very high bar, is it? Maybe as it should be.
So one of the things that has happened is that there have been states that have passed laws that say that their electors will vote based on the popular vote in those states. So that if enough states were to embrace that, that could, in fact, change it without having to change the Constitution.
Carrie, thanks for the call. I guess you could argue, too, that maybe the better solution is to elect or nominate candidates who can appeal to a broader section of the country?
Well, I think the other answer is that we as Democrats have to, you know, reengage with, two-thirds of Americans do not go to college. And the beating the drum about, you know, college leaves out a lot of people. And I am working on a program right now in my district where I'm connecting community colleges with companies in my district that have jobs that are going unfilled because there's not the training. 50 jobs at IBM that require just 3 months of training and you could be making $80,000 a year. So you don't need to even get an AA degree. You may just need a certificate, and that's the kind of thing we've got to work on.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. And Ruth Ann in El Cerrito, welcome.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Congresswoman Speier if she had any intention of signing on to the formal letter of impeachment that Brad Sherman crafted and that Al Green of Texas has signed on to.
So I haven't yet, but I will certainly be reviewing it. And, you know, I think impeachment is one of the tools we have. I think it's a long shot right now, and that's why I've kind of focused in on the 25th Amendment. But I can tell you that I'm certainly open to it and just need to take the time to review those articles.
Is there a – thanks for the call, Ruth Ann. Do you think that there is a chance for Democrats to overreach on this? I mean, you saw what the Republicans did that with Bill Clinton. It's not unprecedented. What are your concerns about
that? Well, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I don't think we want to get into a situation where that's what the Democrats are about in this next cycle.
Voters don't, I mean, when you look at research and people have gone into, or do, there's a group, a PAC that Ellen Tauscher started. They're doing research on congressional districts in California that Hillary Clinton won, but the Republican got reelected to Congress. Russia and Trump are not at the top of their list.
No, they are not. Now, and Russia, it is so complicated that, you know, to expect the voter to understand the nuances of it, when I've spent, you know, the last 6 months, probably 20 or 30 hours a week on it, you know, is asking a lot of a voter. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about it or working on it, because that's our job. We are there as trustees of the voters. So it's really all about job. People want a steady job. They want a stable economy. And they want, I think, to have, you know, a secure future. And by secure future, I think everyone's concerned about potential engagement in North Korea. They're concerned about, you know, the potential of engaging in Venezuela, where that came up. You know, out of nowhere, the president starts saying he's going to send troops to Venezuela. So those are real. Those are the issues that we have got to focus on.
Some comments from listeners. Kurt writes, I listened to Trump's recent Phoenix speech. It was a good speech. He seems quite capable of discharging his duties. I don't believe you can use the 25th Amendment just because you don't like the guy. Noel writes, wait until Mueller is done with his investigations. And Vincent asks, why do you want to remove Trump and make Mike Pence president?
Okay, so the president does really well when he reads the teleprompter. The president shows, I think, his instability when he does extemporaneous speech, when he lashes out at Mitch McConnell and John McCain and Jeff Flake. You know, that's not how you build bridges. That's dividing the country. That's not unifying us.
Dividing his own party.
Dividing his own party, exactly. So, you know, I don't think you look at one speech. I think you have to look at a pattern of behavior. In terms of waiting for the Mueller investigation, will really determine whether or not there are impeachable offenses, I think. I mean, was there abuse of power? Was there an obstruction of justice? Those are the kinds of conditions on which I think you can bring impeachment. And to the idea of Mike Pence, let us remember that the security of this country has got to be paramount. And I don't like Mike Pence. I wouldn't support him. He, you know, was evidently not a very good governor because he was losing his reelection bid when he was running for governor, when he was picked to be vice president. But he is rational. He engages well with people. And at this point in time, we have a national security crisis on our hands.
What would you say to political thinkers observers who say, you know, it would be much better for Democrats if Trump is there in 2018?
And that's the common belief. But what's my job? My job is to protect American citizens to the greatest extent possible. And so I've got to put country before party, too.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Ray in Santa Clara, you're on with Congresswoman Jackie Speier.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question is regarding the voting machines. As I understand it, many of these computerized voting machines are made by a company called Diebold or Diebold.
Diebold is one of them.
In Ohio, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, their parent company actually has given campaign funds in the past to various political groups. But the bigger question is, these machines are proprietary, they're not open source. The code is a mystery. We don't know, the only way to really make sure that a voting machine is fair and to ensure its security is to make sure that it's open source, that anybody can get it, anybody can publish it. I also think it's ludicrous to make a law that says you can't hack one of these machines. You know, if you can buy it on eBay, you should be able to hack it. And if you can hack it, then, you know, that helps. That helps the security, because now you know that it can be hacked.
And Jackie,
you know,
that question about the security of those D-ball machines was a big issue in 2004, I think, the Bush election, where Ohio really was the state that decided the election. What do you think of Ray's concerns?
And I think Ray's concerns are on the mark. I think that, you know, I really think this is one of the areas that we have got to drill much further down. And I'm going to be meeting with a couple of these hackers who were at that hackathon. And it was actually a Diebold machine that they were able to hack into. And, you know, and it's one of those things. And, you know, I'm not a computer scientist, but obviously, but, you know, just developing an algorithm to just, you know, kick out every, you know, 20th vote. You can do that. And they were able to, I think, to do that. We'll find out more. But I think the Congress has got to seriously look at this issue.
All right. Ray, thanks very much for the call. We go now to Oakland. And Jennifer, welcome.
Hi. I'm calling about the Russia investigation. I understand that Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS just testified for 10 hours the other day and presented the Judiciary Committee with 40,000 documents. So I want to get your take on that. And I want to know what role you're going to play in pressuring the committee to release that testimony, because I feel very strongly that that dossier, which was discredited and immediately pounced on by the White House, is going to be central to determining what role the Trump campaign played with Russian collusion. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. And just it was a Glenn Simpson. I don't know that name. Who
he was? I think that is his name. And he was Fusion. He was the person who was interviewed from the company called Fusion. That actual interview went on in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And my understanding is that the chairman, Senator Grassley, has said that he will allow for a vote of the committee to make it public since then. And the attorney for Simpson came out and says, yes, please make it public. So I'm pretty confident we're going to see that transcript.
And to get everybody on the same page, this is the dossier that involved
Christopher
Russia.
Steele. This is the MI6 intelligence officer who was hired by, it appears to be a group that was against Trump, a Republican group against Trump.
Doing opposition research.
Doing opposition research. And it was 40 pages. You can see it online. There's lots of accusations in there, or lots of statements that show linkages that are very troubling. And, you know, they all got foreshadowed by the the hotel room incident. But everyone I talk to has told me that Christopher Steele is a straight up talented intelligence officer who has great sources. So that will be the subject of Mueller's investigation. Certainly the Judiciary Committee has now taken it up, and I believe both intelligence committees will as
well. And the concern is what? That perhaps Putin and Russia has information that could be embarrassing to President Trump, and that's why he seems to have embraced him? And what's the nut of it all?
Well, you know, part of it's kompromat, which is the Russian word for, you know, having compromising information on you, and as a result, they have you under their thumb and can control you. There's been speculation that there's kompromat on the Trump kids, the president himself, and that would be, you know, certainly something of great concern. But there's also much more in that dossier about relationships and business entities. I mean, we've got to look at the fact that there were 65 persons that have bought condos in Trump Towers in Florida and New York that have really shady pasts.
And these are with ties to Russia.
They're oligarchs. They're Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs. And then you look at his relationship with persons that he's done business with. In the end, what I think is going to happen in the Mueller investigation, they're going to find that there was violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which requires persons in this country that do business with foreign entities to do due diligence to make sure that there's no money laundering going on. And I think what we're going to find out that there was plenty of money laundering going on.
On the part of who?
On the part of partners of the Trump Organization building these hotels and facilities.
And then the question becomes, what did the president know and when did he know it?
Well, in some respects, that law requires you to do the due diligence. So you don't have the option of saying, gee, I didn't know.
But that would have happened before he was president. That's not impeachable, right?
It could be.
Depending on the timing.
Well, because in most of these circumstances, he has retained the ownership of these interests, right?
All right. Jennifer, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Berkeley. And Berklia is on the line.
Berklia?
Dean. I'm sorry. Dean in Pacifica. Thanks.
Hi, Congresswoman Spear. I'm one of your constituents. I had a question about the so-called Muslim ban. I have relatives in Iran, my wife's parents, who were approved for a visa, and it's been a couple years now. And I know we've been told that it's not in effect, but I was just wondering if in the background it is.
Well, first thing you should do, Dean, is call my district office and talk to a Stephanie. Because if they have an approved visa and it has not been processed, we can assist in doing that for you. So that's what I would recommend to you at this point.
All right. Thanks very much. We've got some comments from listeners. Ben writes, it seems the Congress needs some bipartisan accomplishments. What issues or projects can the Congresswoman reach across the aisle for?
Good question. And I actually am working with a number of my colleagues on a number of bills that are bipartisan in nature. One of them deals with internet pornography, revenge porn, as it's referred to. And we have, you know, a major effort underway to try and create a federal law around that. The issue of sexual violence, we have a bipartisan task force on sexual violence and how we can address the issues of rape kits not being tested and all the other issues associated with that. And I'm also have been working with a number of my colleagues on legislation regarding military sexual assault and the fact that we have a Uniform Code of Military Justice that is really inadequate to address those issues.
You feel like the military is taking that finally as seriously as you'd like them to?
You know, on any given day, I'd say yes, except we just found out within the last few days that at Fort Benning, training instructors have been asking for sex with trainees, which is against the law. I actually carried legislation to make that the case within the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's a grounds for being discharged from the military. And it appears there are five training instructors who have been involved in either forcibly having sex with trainees or having consensual relationships, both of which are inappropriate in that environment. And as it turns out, one or two of them might have actually been trained as being victims' advocates, which makes me cringe. Mm.
All right, back to the phones. And one of your constituents, I think, Dan in San Carlos.
Hi, Dan.
Is that one of the cities in your district? Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
Hi. So my question was on immigration, specifically illegal immigration. I thought you said that people here should be able to stay and work. I wanted to know, how do you envision having a cap on illegal immigration and limiting the people here, or do you view it should just be an uncapped thing for our country?
No, I think that the intention of the bipartisan bill in the Senate was to, you know, cap it at those who are here and give them a pathway towards citizenship if they paid a fine, if they had not violated the law, and if they got in the back of the line in terms of being able to become U.S. citizens. So those who play by the rules should not be disadvantaged by, you know, creating a pathway. So that's what the legislation would have done, and I supported it, but it was never taken up in the House.
Dan, does that respond to your question?
Does that mean supporting a block on future immigration, like anyone that arrives in the country illegally from today forward be deported?
Well, yes. It creates a means of dealing with the issue we have and, you know, imposing greater restrictions on those who come in and are undocumented.
All right, Dan, thanks very much for the call. Just a couple minutes left here. A listener asks, I live in the Bay Area with all Democrats representing me. What else can I do besides donating and calling? I feel helpless.
Well, you can't feel helpless because...
I wonder if they're a Republican.
Well, I would say that there's plenty that you can do. Engaging with people you know around the country, urging them to call their member of Congress is important to do.
That made a big difference on healthcare, didn't it?
It really did. I think people get so discouraged. They think, oh, my letter doesn't count. My phone call doesn't count. Believe me, it does count. When the phones are ringing off the hook, you get the attention of the member of Congress. And I think that that's important to remember. I also think you can do things like, and there's many groups around the Bay Area that have kind of grown up as a result of the last election and the Women's March that you can engage in. And there's Adopt a Districts where you go to other districts and help register voters. So there are 7 seats in California held by Republicans in which Hillary Clinton won that particular district. So there's an effort underway to try and flip some of those districts.
And a lot of recruitment of candidates, not just,
We're not even recruiting them anymore. They're coming. You've got 4 or 5 Democrats running against these Republicans now. There's a really wonderful engagement that has taken place as a result of the election and people who were frankly asleep and thought that, nothing would change, realize that lots can change and that elections do have consequences.
All right. Congresswoman Jackie Speier, thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for your service. Good to see you.
Great to see you, Scott.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producers are Amanda Stupai and Devin Holt. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald. Our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating 1/3 of its space to arts education.